Accession number 10413, rule 8.
Mr. George Sowell, Reel 8. Before we move on to just looking back on the whole of the 1940 campaign, how did you feel the officers, the senior NCOs and the other ranks, how do you think they performed in action as opposed to in training? Did everything go as it should have done, do you think?
Practically everybody, officers, senior NCOs, carried the duties out as they were taught to carry them out. But, as I say, it was lack of information. They could only do what they were told to do. There was some that... I would think that would be hard if I say they should have been shot. But... there was NCOs that when you were going forward, they were going backwards. And when you were coming back, they were going forward and meet you halfway.
Would that be where they'd found some legitimate reason for doing that? In other words, it wasn't actual running away and then going back. It was, would it be that... that they'd got duties that they could use as an excuse. How did they manage to get away with it? Because you're not allowed to just go off to the rear, are you?
No, no. But they did get away with it. As one of them found out to his cost later on. The other one joined the 2nd Battalion. So what went on with him then, I don't know. But as far as I was concerned, everybody did what they could. As I say, it was quite chaotic. You were fighting alongside your own troops 1 minute, and the next minute you were on your own, because somebody... had got the order to withdraw and you hadn't received it. And there was a lot of these little things going on that...
did the officers...
I would say lack of communications. Did what?
Did the officers provide you with the leadership you'd expected? You know, the...
Some of them did. Some of them did. Some of them... the one you half-hearted...
No failures then?
Not at that particular time. I think some of them could try to a bit more than they did. They were in the same boat as us. It was the first time they'd been under fire. And they didn't want to know what it was like. I mean, it was after Dunkirk, wasn't it, when you went on training, where they started firing live ammunition, which I would think would be a great help.
Did the fatigue affect different people in different ways, or was it...
Oh, yes, you had a lot of people, the fatigue, you know, bugger it, and gave themselves up. Some of them got shot for doing it because the enemy didn't look to see if you had a rifle. He shot you first. But they were that fatigued that they couldn't care less. I suppose they'll be sorry after the event, but at that particular time they were that fed up. Same people, especially around Dunkirk, when they saw people getting on boats and they're standing... waiting at the enemy and couldn't get on a boat till they were told. And it affects you a lot of ways. it affects people different ways. When we came back, it was a lot of people, as far as they were convinced, that was it. You got deserters. You got people that were looking for jobs where they didn't have to go and fight. You got people that it didn't affect. They were looking for action. It depended on the individual. And this is what that particular time, anyhow, nobody wanted to know why you were fed up or what was the reason you were fed up. It was only later that they began to realize that the stress of a man in action can only go on for so long before he's bound to break.
So you got back to Cirencester,
mm-hmm.
and you were just with these 20 people, were you, still? Was it?
No, I hadn't 20 then. There was only about five of us left by
and
then.
The DLI?
Mm-hmm. There was only about five of us left then. And when we got to Cirencester, we were given a bath and went down the QMs for an issue of clothing. And I used to take a size 1 in battle dress. And I got a blouse, size 14. A pair of trousers, size 11. So you can tell what a state I was in. And then we were shown to a billet. And at Cirencester, there were a lot of ATS there. And they were running about showing us where to go and all that.
Whose camp was it? It wasn't the Durham camp, was it?
No. I forget whose it was. I didn't know why. It was the Sherwood Foresters that was there.
But you were just there while they sorted it all out?
Mm-hmm. And I went to bed. And I was asleep. 2.5 days. Never woke up. And I woke up and went for my dinner. And I went down to the dining room and all these ATS was there waiting on you. And this dining room was full of balloons. And I said to my mate, "Them square-shaped balloons, then." And said, "I do not know what they are." I said, "Well, I think I know what they are. They're French letters." And that's what they were. And these ATS blown the boogers up and hung them up for us. And we were there about a week.
Did you manage to get word home?
Oh, yes. I wrote home to my people. And then we were sent up to Knutsford, where the 8th Battalion was reforming. And we were issued at least I was changed my battle dress to one a little bit smaller. Still, it was too big for me, but it was better than the one I had. And we were there 2 days, and then we were supposed to go on 10 days survivor's leave. And a lot of the battalion was already home on leave. And we got on the train. There was a special train stopping at Durham and going to Newcastle. And we got on the train and the RTO and the Red Caps came round and altered all our passes to 48 hours, which we weren't very pleased about. And so the compartment I was in, there was about eight of us, lived in Durham and Stanley. And there was four senior NCOs, a corporal and two privates. And we decided there and then that I think it was a Thursday we were going home, and we were due to come back on the Saturday. That no way were we coming back on the Saturday. And I was coming to, instead of going home, I was coming to Spennymoor to pick the girlfriend up, and then I was going to go home. And so we made a pact that we would all meet in Stanley on the Sunday night and travel back on the Monday. But unfortunately, on the Friday, or the day after we got home anyhow, Italy declared war on Britain. And of course, it was quite a smuzzle. And I began to, I was still at Spennymoor, began to worry about, was I going to be the only one that was travelling on the Monday? And so I decided to go to Stanley, see these lads, and make sure we're all going back together. We're all in the same pot. And I went to Stanley, and as I say, Italy had declared war. And there was an ice cream shop just up the street. We arranged to meet in this pub, and we met in this pub, and there was ice cream parlour just up the street, Italian. And all the civvies was on doors about gun smashing this ice cream parlour up because they declared war on us, and we wouldn't have nothing to do with it. So we agreed we would meet on the night time in this pub, which we did. And we had quite a drink. And as I say, these people were on it again all day long, all night long, to come and smash this Italian bar up. Because one or two by then were in the state of frame of mind also, they would smash it up. And one of the instigators, one of the civvies that was doing all the pushing, was standing in the doorway of this Italian shop. He was going to defend it. And one of the sergeants with me lived straight opposite in a flat upstairs. And we were advancing on this Italian shop. We were going to put the windows in and whatnot. And I saw this rifle come out this window. So I run upstairs. And he had five rounds in the rifle. So I pulled him in, thumped him, took the rifle off him. By that time, I could hear the sound of heavy feet coming up the road. And when I looked out the window, the police had turned the Royal Artillery out. And boy, did they sort us out. Rifle boots the lot. And the lad that I was staying with at his home, they put him inside, locked him up for the night, and told us to come and get him the next morning. Because luckily I'd escaped the RA being upstairs with this other bugle, the rifle. And
Why had the civilian instigator changed sides?
Because he lived above the flat. And he suddenly realised that if we smashed it up, we'd probably go through the lot. Because that worked us up into that kind of a state. And so he was defending his wife and kids was upstairs. So anyhow, we went down the police station the next morning. And we had to bail this sergeant out. And we bailed him out. Me and this lad, this sergeant that had had the rifle, me and him bailed him out. And we went in this middle house, and this civvy was in. So we told him a few home truths. And he said, he said, "Oh, hi, you've got to smash it up. It wouldn't matter to me." But he says, "You're in such a bloody state that I thought you might go through the flat door thinking the Italians lived upstairs." I said, "You shouldn't have egged people on. Should have thought about that before you did." And we decided we would meet at night time and come back instead of waiting till the Monday. And I think it was the Sunday when we came back. And when we got back to Knutsford, about 2 days later, I think it was, because there was no special train. You had to go so far and then change into another train. The battalion had moved from Knutsford down to Rudgeley. So we had to wait at Knutsford till there was enough to fill a lorry, then go down by road. And eventually, we went down to Rudgeley. Now, when we went to, when we came back to Knutsford, we should have had our passage taken off us. And they would have realised we were a day absent. But they didn't ask for our passes. So me and my mate threw them away. But unfortunately, the others didn't. And when we got down to Rudgeley, when we got to the guard room passes, we handed ours in at Knutsford. Okay. The others handed their passes in. And we were showed down to our company lines, what was left of the company. And this sergeant, who had been the one that was going back when we were going forward, and coming to meet us when we were coming back, who was among this party, was sent for. CO's ordered. And he wanted to know why he was on CO's orders and we weren't, the others that had come back. And he was away about half an hour when he came back. He was a private soldier. Now everybody in the battalion knew why he'd been made a private soldier. So he used to get a lot of stick. And after a fortnight, they transferred him to the Corps of Transport Police, not the CMPs. The transport, they had blue hats instead of the red ones. And I've never seen that man from that day to this.
How was the rebuilding going at Rugeley?
Pardon?
How was the rebuilding of the battalion going?
Well, it was going very well. We kept getting drafts from the ITC here and elsewhere. We still had a lot of men that had landed in different ports belonging to the 8th Battalion. But unfortunately, they'd been drafted into the 2nd Battalion to bring it up to strength. So we were left with a nucleus of the old 8th and a lot of raw recruits. And we got a lot of Cosbys. We got people from, later on we got the Welsh Fusiliers, Welsh Borderers. And we gradually built up, back up to battalion strength. And back to the old routine.
You were still training, in C Company. Training.
And I was still in C Company.
And your officer was still...
My officer then was Johnny Walton had been taken prisoner, wounded and taken prisoner. Was then Captain Charles Taylor. And we had a new Sergeant Major, Sergeant Major Craggs. And
you were still just a Lance Corporal,
I was a corporal, still a corporal then, and we did a lot of training around about Rudgeley, and then I think we went down to Weymouth, into Weyforce.
That would be in June.
Mm-hmm.
June 22nd.
And this was the thin red line against the invasion. And just after we got down there, our Tim Bate came back to us. And I was given the job putting a double apron fence up along the beaches at Weymouth and around Paul and Bill.
How did you go about that?
Well, I was given a party of men, 20 men I think it was. And we went down to the REs and put this double apron fence up right along the beach.
How did you fix it into the sand?
It took a lot of doing, but we did. We screwed it far enough in for it to take weight. Wouldn't take a lot of weight. But it did take weight.
How much wire would you put up on them?
Oh, reels and reels and reels. We put up four strands on each side. Four strands running that way. And along Portland Bill, it wasn't so bad because it was like a sand dunes. You know, there was something to grip. It was just something to hold them up long enough to get a bat at them, you know. And then my company was sent down to Abbotsbury. In the Swanage. And we started, I put a double apron fence right along the seafront there, in the fields, because there was a field, then the water, and then the sandbank. And we put mines down, laid mines, and I was made sergeant there.
How did you lay the mines?
Just scooped a hole. Put a debt in, and unfortunately one of the farmer's cows stood on one. Nothing left of the cow.
How were the local civilians? Because you were a northern regiment in this.
Well, in Abbotsbury, yeah, we were stationed just outside. And we didn't get into Abbotsbury. I used to get into Abbotsbury because our company commander was away at the time. I think he was on a course. And Lieutenant Neil was in charge of the party I was with, and he was billeted in a hotel. I forget what they called it. It was like a medieval castle, but on a small scale. And although it's against regulations, once or twice he invited me up for a meal. And I got on quite well with the locals once I got to know who I was. I don't think there was anywhere where, when we were down the south of England, where we were resented. In fact, the whole of my service life, the only place I can ever say that we were resented was in Woking.
When you were with the second?
Mm-hmm. The mothers used to lock the daughters up and chase them off the streets when we walked down.
But that attitude wasn't apparent during the war?
No. I mean, this was peacetime then. I've since been back to Woking after the war, a long time after the war, as a matter of fact. And I was talking to mothers and fathers. I went to a big wedding down there, and I was talking to mothers and fathers, grandfathers and grandmothers, after this wedding reception, that were young married couples, children, when I was down there, and I boned them with this. And that the grandparents said, well, in those days, you know what a soldier was, don't you? George said, I know what some of them was. But there was also decent men soldiers. And so I wouldn't allow my daughter to go with these rogues and vagabonds that were soldiers. And I said, that's possibly true. But I said, you change your attitude during the war. I do know that because I know people that were stationed there during the war. And you couldn't do enough for the same rogues and vagabonds. So why change? They're still rogues and vagabonds. I said, but. And the but's the problem.
Do you remember Montgomery inspects? He was corps commander. Do you remember his inspection?
Yes,
in July.
He came. He came a bit later than that, I think. Didn't he?
Don't know. I thought it was July, but
I think the first time I met Montgomery was Honiton. And we were at a few places before that.
Okay, we'll leave that till then.
He could have been the man I remember was Brigadier Redman. And Martel, was it Martel?
Do you remember any other incidents from life while you were at Amesbury? Do you remember anything else about it, that period? How are the defences coming along?
Well, just after Weymouth, we were sent a bit further along the coast and to Bridport and to Lyme Regis.
Were you always establishing the defences as you went? Or were you occupied?
No, when we got to, I don't know about Bridport and Lyme Regis, I was stationed at that particular time in a little place called Chittagong. It was a seaside place right on the beach itself. And there had been attempts to make it into a defensive position. And our job was to make it better. The only point was lack of weapons.